You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kiko Bourne, and this is Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in D.C. How you doing today? Every Monday at noon, I spend lunch break learning about how people in D.C. and across the country are changing the food system. And at the end of our conversation, I ask each guest for one action our listeners can take to change things for the better. You can see pictures of the show at Kiko Buff on Instagram, and any links that we talk about today will be at kikosfoodnews.com. It's springtime, at least it almost feels like springtime in D.C., which means we're cooking the last of the winter root vegetables and fresh produce is on its way back.
We fly in. Start of spring.
Whoa, morels.
So like a 5 pounder of morels.
Those are honkers.
Yeah. So these are like number one morels getting, you know, probably like commanding a pretty nice premium right
so
now.
So number one morel is based on the size?
Size and like how clean they are.
And how many grades of morel are there?
There's usually two. So the other ones will be a lot smaller. Might be a little dirtier, so you have to process them a little bit
okay.
more. These, like, you really, I mean, they're, like, very clean.
So how many I feel like I'm back at the Capital Area Food Bank, actually, with the sound of all those forklifts in the background. But today we're talking about pallets and cryovac bags and definitely produce. I have DC Produce Man in the studio with me, and we're kicking off Lunch Agenda's distribution series in a warehouse, the Keeney Produce Warehouse in Landover, Maryland, about 15 or so minutes outside of DC, which supplies fruits and vegetables to so many restaurants in this area. But first, Kiko's Food News. First headline of today, speaking of produce, actually, climate change could decrease the yield of some California crops like almonds and rice by up to 40% by 2050. That's clearly a huge deal for farmers in that state who grow more than 400 crops, providing about two-thirds of this country's produce. The prognosis comes from a recent analysis of 89 studies on climate change, which reveal that warming temperatures may alter where crops can grow across that state. Headline two, Iowa lawmakers are moving forward with a law that would require grocery stores to sell conventional eggs from hens raised in battery cages if they also sell specialty eggs with labels like cage-free and free-range. Supporters of the bill say its purpose is for more equity for low-income consumers, but it's stirring controversy as advocates claim it's propping up industrial ag. One family farmer wrote, "The government has no place mandating that grocers must sell a product that family farmers, businesses, and consumers reject." So, yeah, what about the free market determining what grocery stores can sell? But whether it's ultimately enacted or not, the law points to a larger battle that will continue to play out as conventional egg producers look for ways to hang on to as much of the market as possible, while retailers and consumers increasingly choose alternatives like pasture-raised and organic eggs. Headline three, organizations and businesses that believe organic is not enough have formed an alliance and launched the new Regenerative Organic Certification last month. The new alliance, led by the Rodale Institute, Patagonia, and Dr. Bronner's, will oversee the Regenerative Organic Certification instead of the USDA, which oversees the organic label they feel isn't adequately stringent. And the last headline for today, great news for advocates of increasing the wage for tipped restaurant workers. After more than 6 months of organizing and about 350,000 people pushing back on Trump's proposed rule to make tips the property of management, The Department of Labor's proposed tip pooling regulations were overruled. The just-signed bill expressly prohibits employers, managers, or supervisors from collecting or retaining tips made by employees. This victory ties into another important food industry issue. The New York Times recently wrote that the sub-minimum wage for tip workers is the source of the industry's egregiously high rates of sexual harassment. So I'm a big supporter of Restaurant Opportunity Center and the work they've done on this issue, and so this was a real victory. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll introduce you to my guest, DC Produce Man, and we'll talk about distribution. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Lunch Agenda. So what? This is Kiko, and we're kicking off the first episode of our new series, Distribution, The Hidden Link. And you may wonder, why am I calling this series The Hidden Link? Well, that dates back to my early days working at Byright Market in San Francisco. Soon after starting there, I remember hearing a couple business names again and again from the buyers for the market. Names like UNFI and Veritable Vegetable. These weren't brand names that I'd seen on the shelves, but the buyers were always on the phone with these people. So I soon learned that those were Byright's distributors, the companies that the produce and cheese and groceries and other buyers purchased much of their product assortment from. So much of what customers see on the shelf, the price, the variety, the very selection of items that we all find on the grocery shelves and in restaurants has to do with decisions made by distributors. But I had never heard much about them until working on the inside of a grocery store. Do you know anyone who works as a food distributor? I was grateful to meet Jose Morales soon after I moved to DC. And though I've been able to better understand distribution, and since then, and through him, I've been able to better understand distribution, which is often a hidden link in the food chain, I think. I've always wanted him to come on the show, so today's the big day. Welcome, Jose.
Here I am.
Here he is. Welcome to Lunch Agenda.
Thank you for having me.
Let me introduce you officially. Jose was born in the Central Valley of California to parents who were born and raised in Mexico. He started working in food service at the tender age of 7, washing baking sheets at his dad's bakery. And food has always been a focus of his family and his community. He now shares his love for produce with chefs all over the DC area as head of business development at Keeney Produce and Gourmet, a family-owned and operated Landover, Maryland-based distributor, supplying restaurants from Pennsylvania and Delaware all the way down through Virginia and North Carolina. Jose, you've been at Keeney for how many years now?
Almost 7.
Nice.
Yeah, it's
nice.
Been a while.
And you have an undergrad degree from University of California at Berkeley.
Go Bears.
Do you know who you're talking to?
I do, a tree.
And your degree is in integrative biology. Yeah. Not food. They probably didn't have a food degree back then. Stanford didn't when I was there.
No, you know, I didn't even really know that it was an option.
Right.
Being an undergrad.
Totally, so, totally.
Know, I did work at a bakery while I was in college all 4 years called Bake Sale Betty in Oakland. So I was a front house manager for my second 2 years of college. But that's really where my knowledge of how restaurants work from the back of the house to the front of house really came from, was on the job experience, which I think for most food people is how they learn, is through actually being in the business.
Absolutely. How's Bake Sale Betty doing these days? It was all the rage in the years that I lived in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, they're still doing well. They still have a line out the door. They're a lot more get in, get out. But they still, I mean, you know, talked to Betty recently and they still sell over 1,000 sandwiches a day, which, you know, when I started, they were selling no sandwiches, you know, and started with 15, then 30, you know, Betty would run in the back, fry the chicken. And, you know, by the time I left, they were doing about 1,250 a day.
Dang.
Yeah. And, you know, 6 days a week. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So One of the stories that I want to share with guests, with listeners today, is about your family's connection with food. And that'll help explain, I think, why you've devoted your career thus far to distribution. So tell us about your parents' work in food in Mexico and then in the States.
Sure. Yeah, my dad, from an early age, his older brother ran a bakery in his hometown of Cocula, Jalisco, which is a small town in central Mexico. My dad started working there when he was about 7, learned how to bake bread. When he was about 14, he moved to the Central Valley of California, where really the only job for immigrants was, you know, picking tomatoes, picking peaches, picking cucumbers, you know. And back then it was, you know, you'd get paid by the bucket, you know, you'd get paid by the bin of these crops. And he did that for about, I don't know, I want to say 5 years. And he always had this baking skill, which, you know, was a skill that could be used in other ways than just working in the field. So he started working at a bakery. He started, you know, he developed his own route. He would pick up bread and deliver it throughout the afternoons, and saved up his money, bought his own bakery. And I think it was 1984. I was born in 87. So I was born, you know, he always jokes, in the flour sacks. And he sold it. So he went to school full time. My mom helped him with the business. She was also going to school. So he graduated from university in 2000. And he got credentialed to be a teacher by 2001. So he's been teaching now for 18 years. He sold the bakery when he became a teacher. But that really gave him the opportunity to, you know, make his own schedule, go to school. I mean, it took him 10 years from, I mean, he didn't have a high school education. So mm-hmm. he started from adult high school, community college, to the university. And, you know, watching that as a child, and, you know, him working in the bakery, and, you know, they didn't pay for daycare. It was after school. I'd walk to the bakery and he's like, there's some trays for you in the back.
Were you there as a baby and
toddler? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. I mean, when I was about 7 is when I started, like, helping customers, because I could do the arithmetic. So I could say, okay, they're 35 cents a piece for the bread. You know, they got 5 of them. You know, it's a dollar. I can't even.
What was
do
the most
anymore.
Popular bread at your dad's bakery and your parents' bakery? Donuts.
Donuts by far. So you do, you know, glazed donuts, chocolate donuts, maple bars, apple fritters.
Man.
I mean, I was a chubby kid. Chubby.
Thank God you're in produce now.
Yeah, now I think I'm still paying for it. I don't think I've lost my belly since I was
This is a random question, but you said back then pickers were paid by the bucket. What? When did that change, or how is the pay structure now?
I think some of it is still done that way. You know, and
I thought so.
Yeah, so I think some crops are, you get paid by the hour. Some crops, I mean, it's obviously whatever is best for the business. Mm-hmm. You know, it's never about the employees. So for a long time, I mean, I just remember my dad talking about the, you know, the hardest days of work were picking tomatoes, because, you know, you had a bucket, you'd pick the tomatoes, you'd have to run back and forth to the bin, you know, and, like, people, you know, they'd have a foreman sitting there counting, and, you know, usually it was not a Latino person, so, you know, usually it was a white person, so it was like you kind of had a, you know,
a certain power dynamic.
There was a power dynamic for sure. Yeah. But, you know, it was, you know, those stories growing up were very interesting, and, you know, it kind of didn't put you above any type of work. So, you know, for me, they sold the bakery when I was 13, which was in the year 2000. They actually were undocumented and had to go to court, and they, you know, applied for voluntary deportation. And luckily, you know, because my sister had asthma and she was a U.S. citizen, we were able to stay. But, you know, we're pretty close to, you know, the two of them getting deported to Mexico, and, like, my whole family having to go back. Even though I was a U.S. citizen, you know, our family, like, if they had to go, we would all go. Right. And so the summer that I was 14, my mom's friend was dating a foreman planting cauliflower. And now, since they didn't have the bakery, they were now teachers, they couldn't employ me over the summer, which was typically what I would do over the summers. So I started going out, and it was night work, because it gets so hot in the Central Valley. Sure. During the summer, you know, 110, 115 degrees, that You'd have to work overnight planting cauliflower. So with, you know, big lights, you'd sit on the back of a tractor for about 10 hours a day. So we'd start at 10 at night and get off at 8 a.m.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know,
at 14, which is legal. Like, I could get through high school, get a work permit, and go do that at 14 years old, which is, to this day, I'm just like, wow, that's really crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So your parents picked produce out of necessity, you say.
Yeah.
You know, got some extra money in your pocket during high school by planting cauliflower. You said you picked figs in summers, too. Was this ever something negative that you wanted to forget or you were ashamed of versus moving into this field professionally?
No, I think my parents made work a part of being proud. I don't know. I've never been ashamed to do work. Yeah. And, you know, it must be, you know, I mean, you know, they're very, you know, they're, the Mexican culture is like very big in my family. My parents always taught us to be proud of who we are because we're not anybody else. Like, your name's Jose. Like, you know, you go, you know, my name on my
own, it, boy.
Everything is Jose. So, you know, it's, they were always very proud as well. You know, don't let anyone put you down. And, you know, and I think that that's just kind of never really been an issue for me.
And what I've heard you talk about that's really powerful about the legacy of their work in the fields and you knowing what it's like to plant is that you therefore have an appreciation for the human side of produce and of food. And you know, whether it's conventional or organic or whatever, just how human heavy food and produce is.
Definitely.
You know, those of us who follow the ag sector hear a lot about mechanization, whether it's planes flying over the field spraying fertilizer, whether it's machines that pick and sort produce. But your experience and hearing you talk about it has really taught me how the human touch is so present on, you know, every piece that we see in mountains in the grocery shelves and on our restaurant plates.
I mean, for the most part, you know, any piece of produce that you are putting on your plate has been touched by human hands.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a few you know, canned tomatoes. But if you're eating fresh produce, I mean, that, you know, more than likely went through.
And not only one human, you know, what we're really going to be talking about with distribution is so many steps of humans and their attention and their respect for the produce, getting it to you.
Yeah.
And I have to say, this is why your voice is so welcome on Lunch Agenda. I was reflecting on my educational mission of this show and realized that ultimately my goal with this show is to elevate the value of food in people's minds. Last month I had a farmer, Heinz Tomet, give a stat on the show that Americans spend 11% of their budgets on their money on food, whereas, you know, French people spend 22%. And I just deeply believe food is worth more money, more time, more energy. And one way to help us all appreciate that is this idea of how many humans, not to mention how many tons of water and all the other things that are important resources, go into our food. So, Keeney, yeah. What does Keeney do as a produce distributor for someone who doesn't understand distribution?
So we essentially warehouse a ton of fruits and vegetables. I mean, we have, you know, anywhere from $3 to $5 million worth of produce in our stores. We turn that probably every 2 days. It really comes from all over the world. It's a bunch of different things, you know, rail cars of potatoes, rail cars of onions to, you know, microgreens from California, you know, to just pallets of oranges and, you know, really, you know, everything and everything, anything and everything that people would want tomorrow.
Yeah,
so, you know, people come to us because they want the convenience of, I need it tomorrow. I need it in 12 hours. And, yeah, you know, we offer that. That's really the space that we live in.
Right. I was really inspired seeing the delicacies in there when I visited the warehouse, whether it was borage blossoms, which I had never eaten, I don't think, cactus leaves, or are they called paddles or leaves?
Yeah, leaves or paddles.
You know,
nopales.
See, you know, turmeric and tons of edible flowers and little peppery radish greens that you let me taste. It's like the Garden of Eden in there,
yeah.
Or Garden of Eaten.
Garden of Eaten.
Garden of Eaten.
But, you know, it's the stuff that people want. You know, I mean, it's, we are really driven by what chefs ask for. I mean, that is our mission. You know, we need to stay in business. We're a family-owned company. You know, we try to run a tight ship. The Keeneys started with one van back in the Florida market 40 years ago. Now, you know, we have about 160 trucks. We have two distribution centers. So, you know, and they really are responsible people when it comes to their product and how they treat their employees. And yeah, we're completely driven by chefs. We try to listen to them. We try to understand what they want. We try to get ahead of it, you know.
Yeah, speaking of getting ahead of it, one of the things that you let me see in the warehouse was the pre-cut department,
yeah.
Which is just this monster room with a staff of about 130 that you were responsible for managing as you're in your first role at Keeney, which I find mind-boggling. And these professionals are peeling butternut squash, shredding carrots, tourneying potatoes. It's the restaurant prep that happens before the restaurant kitchen, and most of us diners would have no idea about that step in the chain.
Yeah, definitely. And we, you know, we try to keep the quality standards to what would a chef do in their kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I was managing that department, I mean, I was on the floor, like, if something was not up to snuff, like, hey, you know, you got to change your process. You got to do it differently because chefs are going to, you know, they want you to do this a certain way.
Right, right. And one thing I found interesting that you've told me is that you've started talking to Little Wild Things, which is an urban farm in D.C. that produces microgreens and edible flowers. And to me, that feels like an interesting case study of the levers of distribution because they're not a huge operation. And so I don't think they're Keeney's average supplier. And I wonder what you would say would stand in the way of selling their sprouts. You know, what is it like to work with a smaller producer like that? And how does it work or not work for their bottom line or Keeney's bottom line or model?
I mean, a lot of it is just leveraging the message to the chefs, right? I mean, it's transcribing the, you know, the beautiful things that Little Wild Things does and making sure that a chef understands why that micro basil is 20% more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. Are you willing to do that because that's what you want? And, you know, it's our job to, hey, if you really are going to do this, you know why. Understand that you're supporting a local business. You're supporting local agriculture. And, you know, Little Wild Things is just like one, you know, we deal with
sure.
Between 70 and 100 local farms from Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
Yearly.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, all sizes, you know, 5 acres, you know, to, I mean, thousands.
Right, right. So tell us about the distribution field in the DMV that for non-DC listeners, that's the district, Maryland and Virginia. Who are your competitors and who are the biggest players in local food distribution here?
Wholesale, I would say our biggest competitors are going to be Coastal, Sunbelt. So they're out of Jessup, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
They are owned by private equity. So they're, you know, they're big. They're a little more corporate, I think.
As opposed to the family-owned business model of Keeney.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then there's Baldor out of New York,
mm-hmm.
Who, again, they're just like a... I mean, they're 2.5 times our size. You know, they carry everything from soup to nuts. So, you know, finding the value that we have that we can add and that we can bring to the table at Keeney Produce. So, you know, doing warehouse tours with chefs. That's a really huge one. You know, chefs come out, you know, I'll treat them to some tacos and we'll go and check out the warehouse and, you know, they'd be able to touch things, look at things, you know. We also have a Gateway to Gourmet truck, which is a, we retrofit one of our delivery trucks with racking,
mm-hmm.
and we put a lot of specialty items on the truck and take it out and stop at a loading dock, you know, at a hotel, at different caterers, mm. And, you know, the chefs come on, they're able to touch and feel, take samples.
It's like a kinda little produce petting zoo.
Yes, it's a produce tasting zoo.
Tasting zoo.
Yeah. Sometimes it is a zoo.
How much of Keeney's produce is local, and what kind of chefs can and can't you work with, therefore?
I would say local's growing. I would say probably over the year, about 12% is local.
Okay.
But, you know, you have to think about, you know, we have to do commodity potatoes, commodity onions, lettuce from California. You know, there's a lot of, you know, mescaline, you know, spinach. There's a lot of stuff that we can't grow as efficiently here as they do in California, where, like, these industries are extremely robust.
Mm-hmm.
Some chefs, I mean, you know, it's a matter of preference. I mean, you know, if you're going to deal with Baldor or Coastal or us, you know, like, you're going to get non-local product, you know, but we try to do a really good job of, like, in the summer, like, we only sell local zucchini. In the summer, we only sell local kale, local mustard greens. There's no, we're not bringing it in from Texas. It's all local, which is tough because sometimes, you know, if we have a really bad thunderstorm here with some hail, you know, we could lose a whole crop of kale that we were expecting. So now we're scrambling and we haven't been buying any from anybody else.
Right.
So our pipeline's dried up.
You're not hedging your risk.
Yeah. Which is, I think that becomes a tough part of really focusing only on local.
Uh-huh. I thought it would be fun today to showcase an alternate approach to distributing local food to chefs that happens every spring, just kind of as showing the broad range of what distribution can look like. Arcadia Center for Sustainable Food and Agriculture has for the past 6 years hosted something they call the Farmer Chef Speed Sourcing Happy Hour at Blue Jacket Brewery in D.C. Whereas Keeney makes it easy for chefs to order produce efficiently, this event is not efficient. It involves chefs getting to know individual farmers over beers and building relationships over the years that this event has happened. Now I believe it's six, to the point that restaurants would place orders for a specific produce item or a full animal in some cases. So I had the opportunity to attend this year, and I was able to interview many of the growers and ranchers along with the chefs about how this type of relationship building fits in with their business model. I thought I'd play a clip of Arcadia's executive director, Pamela Hess, who plans the event, talking about this unique approach to distribution.
If a farmer is going to be successful, they need to have a diversified income stream so that if their markets don't work out, they know that they always have some restaurant income coming in, or if their wholesale market isn't working, they have direct-to-consumer sales to rely on. So what we do here is to try to make it easier for farmers to make those connections. Farmers and chefs are very unique personalities as a group. They are both control freaks, bosses, type A personalities, often very introverted, and they both, in ways that are really defensible, think that they're the most important link in the chain. So, what we found is that if you can find a way to open them up a little bit, relax them, and let them meet as humans and not across an event table with a lot of literature being handed out, but instead over a beer, if they like each other as people, they're going to move mountains to work together. And unfortunately, with local food, you sometimes have to move mountains to work together. The challenge with local food for chefs is that if they're buying from smaller local farms, they're going to be receiving food from 20 different farmers during the week, writing 20 different checks, and having these farmers showing up at weird times because they get stuck in traffic or whatever. So the temptation is always to go with the really easy big distributor who shows up once, bills you, you're net 45, you know that you can get whatever it is that you want to get. But if you really want to serve beautiful local food, you really got to be working with beautiful local farmers. It's just harder. We think it's worth it, and we're trying to find ways to make it easier.
So you were smiling and nodding when she was talking about farmers and chefs being control freaks. You are day-to-day the link between those two. Do you align with this view of their personalities?
100%.
Okay.
Totally. And for me, if a chef wants to go and buy directly from a farmer, I will help in whatever way I can.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, not every farmer can go to 100 restaurants in a day.
Sure.
You know what I mean? The volume of restaurants and, like, the volume of the orders have to make sense for both parties.
Right.
So, you know, for us, we're one drop for the farmer.
Yeah.
So they come to our warehouse. The cold chain's never broken because it comes in a refrigerated truck.
Yeah.
Goes right to our dock. We put it in inventory. Now they're able to sell it to 120 restaurants.
Right. Right.
So...
Whereas the big victory that day, Pam told me, was Martin Farm selling a whole pig to Blue Jacket. You know, it's a different scale.
Yes.
Ultimately, I think Keeney's business model is a window into how the restaurant industry functions today. You know, Keeney delivers, you said, 98% of your product to food service customers. So those are restaurants whose margins are very thin. So for most of them, paying an extra 30% on food costs for organic isn't feasible. Is what you told me.
I mean, unless they can charge for it. I mean, everyone, you know, the first part of sustainability is staying in business.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you told me that 120 or so restaurants went out of business in DC last year.
Yeah.
So food costs are a huge part of that, and organic demands such a high premium. And until organic grows to the scale of conventional, you know, it could be that the restaurants on these tight margins won't be able to make it fly unless, you know, they are telling the story and able to, you know, attract someone who will pay for that.
One, it always starts small. I mean, there's always, you know, like now organic spring mix is like, okay, it's gotten to a volume now where it's pretty comparable in price. Organic spinach, comparable in price. But, mm-hmm. you know, you're still, you know, organic apples, still a huge problem. You know, it's really hard to grow good organic apples.
Yeah, I was at Fresh Farms DuPont Market yesterday, and there's only one of the many apple vendors doing organic.
Farm at Tennessee.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, okay.
So the last question I want to ask you before you offer your action item for our listeners is, what changes you've seen in distribution and what that might mean for the future? So, you know, I did ask Pamela Hess that, and she said that the farmers are more diverse. You know, at her event, she was noticing there were many more African-American farmers there, for example, which is, you know, a great development. What about what you see for, you know, big scale distribution over the next, let's say, 25 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to get more efficient and less efficient at the same time. So, you know, with e-logbooks, I think freight is going to start becoming like a big issue. So until we really get automated trucks, food cost is going to go up, which is great for local farmers because they're going to be able to command the premiums. Because right now the local farmers have trouble competing with the big conventional farms because they're so much less expensive than they are.
Right.
But as those costs rise, you know, a local farmer is going to be a lot more competitive on the larger scale if they can scale up and do it in a responsible way, because I mean, freight is becoming a huge issue. I mean, that's just one. And, you know, automation in warehousing, you know, produce is pretty interesting because of the human aspect. You know, a robot can't look at a case of collards and know if there's rot at the bottom
or handle soft and
delicate
is the word, produce.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And, you know, or maybe they can, but you know, maybe they're just not invented yet, we don't know.
Right.
But you know, I would say with the food costs are going to continue to rise, you know, with the increase in labor costs, you know, I mean, again, people are going to start, you know, it's only going up now, you know, with the increases in minimum wage, the e-log books, you know, so unless we can get some like true efficiencies in other places, you know, which that works really difficult. I mean, you know, we can't find, you know, everyone talks about immigrants coming here and taking people's jobs. There's plenty of jobs picking apples and strawberries in California and Washington. Like, just go out there and do it for a few days. And I mean, it's incredibly, incredibly hard work. And that to me is just, you know, they should be getting paid more. And like, I think we all need to be, you know, not looking for the cheapest apple, but the most responsible apple, which, you know, you talk about Patagonia and like those people creating like a more holistic than just organic.
Right.
I think that if we can truly sell it and get it to a place where it's like equitable for everyone in the ecosystem, you know, we'll hold water, but the problem becomes how does wholesale and restaurants, how do they incorporate it? Because, you know, Mom's Organic Market does a wonderful job with their sourcing and their produce, but they're a tiny piece of the greater food system. And that's not including any catering, restaurants, hotels.
Institutionals.
Yeah. That are a huge driver of the food. Right. Retail is obviously a huge market, but, you know.
Yeah. So what do we do about this? What do you want to ask listeners to do in our day-to-day? What's your agenda item?
Eat more produce. Is that too simplistic?
No. Why?
Drive down cost. The more we all eat it, the cheaper it's going to get. Mm. And not cheaper, the less expensive it's going to get.
Right.
You know, we have to give produce value, and the way we do that is by spending more money on it.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah. So
eat more produce, and that's going to make it better for everybody.
Said by DC Produce Man. Thank you, Jose, for helping us wrap our heads around one of the least visible, least glamorized links in the food chain. And thank you for doing this work, more importantly.
Yeah, give me a follow on Instagram or Twitter and DM me. And if you want to learn more,
yeah,
I'm happy to help.
And that's at DC Produce Man. And for pics from my visit to Keeney's Warehouse, check out Kiko Buff, which is my Instagram. If you share this podcast across social media, please include the hashtag Lunch Agenda. And next Monday, we'll look at another type of food distribution, grocery. It's going to be a fun one because I'll have a brick and mortar grocer debating with a grocery delivery executive about the future of their industry. See you then.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.